Like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is currently 1:06 p.m. on Tuesday, March 31st, in room 124. Members present are Representative McCabe, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, Co-Chair Eichheid, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, as well as Jude Augustine from the Juno LIO. And our committee aides, my staff, Griffin Sukeo, and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. Thank you all for your help. On today's agenda, we are hearing a presentation from the Department of Transportation on the Alaska Trails and Local Access Systems, or ATLAS, from Rebecca Garrett, who's our Frontier Roads and Sustainability Program Manager. I'd like to welcome Ms. Garrett to the Transportation Committee. If you'd like to come on up and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. And we're also joined by our special assistant, Andy Mills. And we have also just been joined by Representative St. Clair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Carrick and Eichheid, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to present to you today. My name is Rebecca Garrett, and I'm the Frontier Roads and Sustainability Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Commissioner's Office. In this position, I oversee initiatives that connect rural communities through seasonal infrastructure. Today, I'll cover what Alaska Trails and Local Access Systems, or ATLAS, is, how it functions as transportation infrastructure across Alaska, and what we can expect from integrating these programs more fully into the state's transportation system. I'll also cover current funding and demand and highlight a few areas where legislative support can help us access and improve safety across the state. ATLAS is a statewide transportation system focused on trails and seasonal infrastructure. In much of Alaska, traditional roads don't exist and aren't feasible, so these programs provide critical access between communities and essential services. The program is delivered through strong partnerships with tribes, local governments, nonprofits, and include multi-use trails, ice roads, winter trail marking, and snow machine trails. This is transportation infrastructure. It's just delivered differently. In much of rural Alaska, these trails are the transportation system. They provide access to healthcare, education, and essential services where no roads exist. They support subsistence in local economies. They improve safety and give search and rescue teams a reliable network to operate from. And importantly, they do this in a cost-effective way compared to what it would take to build the same network with a traditional road construction system. This map highlights how ATLAS expands transportation beyond the road system. For example, an ice road from Fort Yukon to Circle connects into the highway system, allowing travel to Fairbanks, something that would otherwise require costly air travel. These types of connections reduce expenses, improve access, and increase reliability for rural communities. This is how we extend the transportation network into areas where permanent roads aren't feasible. With that context, I'll walk you through each of the core programs that make up ATLAS. ATLAS is made up of four core programs, each serving a different role within the transportation system. Multi-use trails provide a year-round infrastructure and are funded through federal reimbursement programs. The Safe Ice Roads program supports seasonal routes that connect communities during the winter months. Winter trail marking focuses on safety, helping people navigate, and supporting search and rescue. And snow machine trails are maintained through partnerships with local nonprofits and support winter travel and recreation. Together, these programs create a flexible, statewide system that adapts to Alaska's geography and seasons. The Multi-Use Trails Program, formerly known as the Recreational Trails Program, or RTP, is a federal reimbursement program. It funds the construction and maintenance of trails, as well as safety and educational improvements. The program supports both motorized and non-motorized uses, reflects how Alaskans actually use trails across the strait. Administrative Order 361 transferred this program to DOT MPF, allowing us to better integrate trails into the broader transportation system. It's highly competitive, and the demand consistently exceeds available funding. We are seeing strong interest from communities statewide, but limited funding means not all eligible projects can move forward. Recent applications requested over $3 million in funding. One advantage of this transfer is the ability of the department to convert and utilize other federal funds to meet and even potentially grow this program. We look forward to coming back to you in future years with a report on these efforts.
If we could actually pause here, I think this is super fascinating, Ms. Garrett. Thank you for bringing this information to us. Can you tell us just a couple of examples of trails that DOT has under its, like this trail that's pictured here? What are some of the multi-use recreational trails currently within DOT's purview?
Multi-use trails? None. They were just transferred to us from Department of Natural Resources, so DNR will continue to finish those projects to the end. And we just completed an application cycle, so we should have some trails here in the next few months or some projects that fall under RTP.
And then as a, and I have Representative McCabe in the queue as well, but just as a follow-up, you had said around $3 million in requests, and can you talk a little bit about what were some of the smaller requests and what were some of the largest requests, like just to understand the variety that of requests that's coming in?
To the chair, the smaller requests are for safety and education, and those typically have to be funded and completed in one fiscal year. And the larger request would be to build new trails or facilities. But I apologize, I did not bring a list with me, and I can get back to you with those, with that information.
I think that would be great. It'd be really interesting to see the variety. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So I'm interested in this because the RTP program seems to have become a little political between motorized and non-motorized users. So I'm interested to know, is it just DOT that's funding and working on RTP, or is it DOT and DNR?
So Andy Mills, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, in Administrative Order 361, the governor made that transition for sort of several reasons, but one that was articulated was to ensure that there was parity in the program among these motorized, non-motorized, and diversified, which are called out in the CFR for the recreational trail program by the federal government as a requirement. And that's why we have to have a body, which in this case is RTAC, the Alaska Recreational Trail Advisory Committee, which is DOT's committee that was established to ensure that parity when we're reviewing. But it, just so I could say, the RTP program has general eligibility, and of course the criteria is something that we work with this governing body, now made up of members that represent motorized, non-motorized, diversified, and some other categories, which we can talk about later. And they do attempt to seek better balance in what the awards look like and what that criteria looks like.
Follow up. Thanks. You're so politically correct, Andy. I can hardly stand it. So the issue is I hear about this all the time because of my involvement with the snow track funding and with the snowmobile clubs and with the motorized folks on motorized trail users, mostly in the Mat-Su. But I heard about one recently up on the hillside in Anchorage where the people that ride bikes and snow machines up there claimed that the non-motorized trails were being prioritized over the motorized trails. And haven't really delved into it too much because I've been too busy, but their claim is, hey, look, this is supposed to be shared equally, and it appears like the non-motorized trails are getting maintenance, getting plowed or whatever, and the motorized trails are not being prioritized at all. So I'd be interested to know kind of how that went, and you can imagine where I'm getting my information from. But
So again, through the chair to Representative McCabe, yeah, I'm familiar with that particular situation on the hillside, and I know that there was a perceived delay in motorized access to that trail. And again, coordination with DNR, who was working on that particular project, that has since been opened up to motorized traffic, and DOT will continue to work with DNR on areas where RTP funds have been used previously and where any might be applied in the future.
One more, if you don't mind.
Follow-up, yeah.
So this kind of begs the question. So the motorized folks say, hey, look, our taxes, what we pay for licensing and when we buy the vehicle, and whether it be the snowmobile license or the four-wheeler license, or are supposed to be going to these RTP things and having them prioritized or having them not being worked on when the non-motorized trails are worked on seems to them to be sort of, you know, kind of, they see it as a problem. So I guess the question is do we need, again, you're going to be political again, but do we need to take the DNR out of the mix?
Through the co-chair to Representative McCabe, I want to give you the political answer, which is we're all good partners in state government trying to serve. But the answer is, through Administrative Order 361, DOT has been tasked with managing and running the recreational trail program. So any concerns that folks have had in the past, which, again, I believe we saw as part of this transition, are meant to be addressed by having DOT in that lead role administering this program. So I would encourage any folks who have issues, and the hillside was one that was elevated to DOT, and it has since been resolved. If you see others around the state, we continue to work on resolving those issues as they're raised.
Cool. Thanks.
And I have Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, I think this is probably for Mr. Mills. Thank you for that dialogue. That was very interesting. I think, forgive me if I'm misinterpreting, but I think what you just said will change from DNR to DOT. It's kind of like a reset for maybe the history, and I'm not sure of the history. So I guess my question is, you know, DOT does a lot. You know, all the agencies do a lot. So did DOT shift something onto DNR or offload one of your responsibilities because it takes capacity to run trails? So we've talked about reorganization in DOT. What did you add more to your plate with this, or did you give something away so there's parity? I heard the word parity, even though I think you had a different meaning. Please.
Yeah. So through the co-chair to the co-chair on this one. From parity, you're right. We were talking about the accessibility of grants to different groups. And when we're talking about parity within the departments, yes. DOT took on, actually a few years ago, the snow grooming program, the snow trail grooming program. Snow track, I think, is actually one of the former terms for it. But it was for grooming snow trails, for snow machine access. And, of course, you can imagine there are a lot of users that use snow machine trail access, not just snow machines themselves. And so for that, we assume that 2-3 years ago. Yeah. Someone knows that one. And we have since then with Ms. Garrett worked on integrating, again, that's part of this presentation, integrating the frontier roads, the ice roads, the winter trail markings, and this under one umbrella of our program. And so when we took RTP on, we already had a subset of RTP, which was the snow machine grooming program. And in transitioning it, we have been working with some DNR staff who had worked on this program and are working on making sure we resource it in DOT with some of those staff, whether it's transferring it from DNR or whether we stand up from a vacancy we already have to ensure that this program has that administrative support. But to answer your question, we already had a subset of it, and we've taken on the larger program at this point.
Follow up. That makes perfect sense to me. So thank you for that. And just for the record, you know, there's within between groups and within groups, there are tensions. I know I'm a classical cross-country skier, and classical cross-country skiers don't like it when skate skiers go into their groomed track. But I would like to just say for the record, a lot of non-motorized users, like runners, like myself, I use groomed tracks and trails, as well as fat bikers. You know, we love our single track, but we also love a good packed thoroughfare. So just thank you.
And because we're asking some, you know, broader questions, I think this might be a good time to ask also. Remind me again, first of all, where state parks revenue goes to.
So to the co-chair, that's a question I'm not sure because it's DNR for state parks. Rick, I believe Director Geese would be the one who could answer that effectively. RTP funds, which we can speak to, come from Fed Highways, and they were previously coming through DOT to DNR. And so in this case, with the administrative order modifying that, they are staying with DOT at this time.
Okay. I'll save the other frame of questions for DNR sometime. But for the, I guess going back to the RTP funds, is there any kind of mandate on how those funds get spent on motorized versus non-motorized trail work?
Let me say this. So, Madam Co-Chair, yes, there is a split. In fact, one of the core tenets of the recreational trail program is a 30-30-40. So 30% for motorized, 30% for non-motorized, and 40% for diversified. And that split carries into the membership of the committee that we've set up and we'll talk about soon, and also for the distribution of those funds. I'll note now, since we're talking about funds, and I believe Ms. Garrett will also touch on this, one of the many reasons for Administrative Order 361 was also, again, our Federal Highway Administration partners were looking for DOT. They supported DOT taking on the larger RTP program from a financial compliance standpoint. Not that I understand anything with DNR was not in compliance, but DOT has, as a course of regular business with our FedAid program, reporting in FEMIS, the financial system for Fed Highways. And because we have that sort of daily inputting and compliance check for finances, that was one more rationale that either DNR needed to spool up a competency and access on that, or that DOT would assume the program to ensure that we were working within that system on federal compliance. And then additionally, which I believe Ms. Garrett will also touch on, one of the other advantages that we have yet to realize for RTP is the ability to use other Fed aid and convert it to RTP funding, thereby extending the program, as long as we, of course, can find suitable match that would work with it. And that allows this program to grow in time, given whatever demand we may encounter with DOT administering it differently and doing additional outreach.
Okay, thank you.
Good question.
Yeah. Please continue, Ms. Garrett.
Thank you. For the record, Rebecca Garrett, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The Multi-Use Trails Program has recently undergone an important transition. In October of 2025, Administrative Order 361 moved RTP from the Department of Natural Resources to DOT. This allows us to better align with Alaska's broader transportation system and planning efforts. The program is also supported by the Alaska Recreational Trails Advisory Committee, or RTAC. This is a federally required committee that represents a range of trail users across the state. The committee provides recommendations on project selection and helps ensure that the process is transparent and community informed. This slide shows the RTAC committee and the user groups they represent. We've had four meetings to date and have an application review meeting scheduled on May 7th. Meeting packets and recordings can be accessed at the RTAC website. One of the primary goals for RTAC in this first year of their efforts is to review and update the RTP criteria, which is underway, that will ensure the program is meeting all the needs of all the transportation users that rely on RTP grants to maintain and improve trail access. In addition to year-round trail infrastructure, we also support seasonal routes through the Safe Ice Roads program.
And we'll pause here for a minute. I have Representative Mina, and then I also have a question, too, and Representative Stutz, too.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, I know that it was mentioned that in the last slide that the multi-use trails and the RTAC, that they'll be incorporated in the statewide transportation planning. So how does RTAC interact with MPOs and other statewide transportation plans?
Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to Representative Mina. There is not going to be interaction per se. So RTAC is really a group of, again, public members who represent both the mixture that RTP funds requires, which is that motorized, non-motorized, diversified. But in this case, beyond those three categories, we really tried to reach out and ensure that we were bringing other voices to the conversation that were important. So in this case, as an example, Ms. Sargent, who's on here, represents Search and Rescue, a very qualified individual who brings a different lens when we're looking at this program, because most folks may not know, and I guess fortunately may not know, that many of these unconventional access routes are vital to reach folks. I've been notified, and I don't know for sure, but DPS, I believe, doesn't run night operations with their helicopters after an unfortunate incident some years ago. And so if you're in the dark and you're in a search and rescue situation, that may limit some of your options to getting out to some remote areas. And therefore, some of these access points are life, health, safety directly. And so, and then of course, Mr. Collins on that list is from the area of Nome, and works, I believe, with Quarick. So we have a very diverse, both geographically and also in their functional technical expertise on this group.
Just a quick follow-up.
Thank
you. Through the co-chair, how is diversified users defined?
So through the co-chair to Representative Mina, I can get you the official, I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but diversified in its essence means that you have, again, multi-use, not one use. In Juneau here, we have trails that are, you cannot bring motorized on, and trails that are motorized. And so diversified would be if you could have both. And of course, making sure the importance on those when you do have a mixture. So unfortunately, I believe there was an incident where a dog sled and a snow machine resulted in, a fatality. And that is a situation where this diversified user group can bring a unique lens to how you integrate different modes on the same access. And there are different considerations for that we want to care for.
Thank you.
And then I had put myself in the queue as well. How does one get appointed to the RTAC? I know a few of the people on this list, and I'm glad they're on this committee, but how did they get appointed?
Madam Co-Chair, so we did a solicitation as a request for information that we kind of pushed it out. We received quite a bit of interest, which was great. And again, tried to get geographic. I agree with Mr. Campo and Ms. Juhas. We have some good Fairbanks firepower in here as well. But we will run solicitations. I think at this moment we have an annualized basis for potential renewal of folks. If we ever need to fill a seat, we would run another solicitation or draw from the names that we have and see if any of those individuals are still interested, or perhaps a combination of both. So.
And just as a quick follow-up, are these seats designated as, do they have to be one motorized, one non-motorized, and four diversified, or could it be a different combination?
Yeah, Andy Mills, for the record, Madam Co-Chair, the minimum requirements under program guidance for this representative body that makes informed decisions on and advice on RTP grants has to have one motorized, one non-motorized, and one diversified. Beyond that, those three seats, there it does not specify more. We've expanded this to have those additional, again, technical expertise and geographic distribution. And also, if you have a minimum quorum of three in those seats that you need, having additional members does allow you to hold meetings more frequently, less conflicts. So it does not prescribe beyond the three modes what seats are required.
And then I thought that was my last follow-up. But one final follow-up on the composition of the RTAC is, are these individuals self-identifying as diversified or non-motorized or motorized users?
Madam Co-Chair, each of the individuals that submitted when we put out a notice provided a resume and a bit of description on how they met the criteria, and then we make an independent determination. And I made a bunch of phone calls on every single one of these individuals, except for one, to validate that background as well.
Representative Stutes, hopefully I didn't ask your question.
No, that's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. I notice there's no geographic designation on these individuals. Can you give me an idea what the distribution is geographically of these individuals? Because I notice it seems like DOT seems to be consolidating a little bit more, and I just wondered what this was. Thank you.
Through the chair, the co-chair to Representative Stutes, thank you. It's one more way we can display the list. So let me go through this real fast. So Mr. Craig Campo is from the Fairbanks area with a long history in motorized activities and groups. Ms. Juhas is diversified in that she has representation in non-motorized and motorized activities, a fairly substantial resume as well. Ms. Hart is from the Haines area down here in Southeast Alaska as our non-motorized. Again, substantial experience. I believe one of them was previously working for an ARDR and having worked on community transportation. So there's quite a history on that. Ms. Agnew is from the Anchorage area, substantial advocacy and effort on, I believe it's the outdoor, taking people out into the outback, not outback, but on excursions that are off trail, so to speak, and getting them to some fairly remote areas, both motorized and non-motorized. Mr. Collins is from the Nome area, as I mentioned previously, and diversified. Again, you're talking traditional trails, subsistence use, motorized use. I was privileged to go up to Kotzebue at one point and see a class going out on snow machines for a hunt to get out to some areas. It was fantastic. So there's a lot in rural Alaska that we're appreciative that Mr. Collins brings. Mr. Valentine is from, I believe, the Glen Allen area, and is diversified as well with a history in, I believe, non-motorized primarily, but also non-motorized. And Allie Sargent, I understand, is from a couple different areas, but the Matsu in particular, with search and rescue. I believe it was Palmer. So, but in the valley, is my understanding.
Appreciate that. I appreciate that. And I'm sorry, where did you say Ms. Juhas was
Fairbanks.
From?
Yes, from the Fairbanks area. Although, again, many of our members, like Ms. Hart and Ms. Juhas, while they live in one place, they are frequent travelers, and they are kind of almost a statewide voice, so to speak, because they work with a lot of groups across the entire state.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, and it is quite diverse and spread out, so I think that's great. Thank you.
Excellent. I'd like to note that Representative Nelson has joined us at 1:34 p.m. Please continue.
Thank you. For the record, Rebecca Garrett. The ICE Roads program supports the construction of seasonal ICE roads that connect remote communities. These projects are typically led by tribes and local governments with support from DOT. This season, we anticipate approximately 750 miles of ICE road across the state. We've also secured federal funding for the first time this construction season, which is a major step forward for the program. These routes provide significantly lower cost alternative to air travel for things like medical trips, goods, and community travel for sports or to attend events. One of the biggest challenges we see is access to equipment and capacity at the local level to build and maintain these roads. For many communities, this is the most practical way to create a road connection. In addition to building routes, safety is a major focus. Our winter trail marking programs support that.
And Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So we tried to do this at Big Lake. We have a significant trail, Ice 5, they call it, actually, around Big Lake. And it goes to a number of houses that are not on the road system. In the summertime, they access them with a boat. And in the shoulder seasons, they try to use one of those dangerous little hovercrafts. But the problem is they ran into an issue with insurance. So the guys that were plowing the roads decided that if they were funded by the state, that they would somehow be might be liable than if more liable than if they were just volunteers doing it, which is what they're doing now, if there was somebody that broke through the ice or something. So my question is there any chance that the state is putting together any kind of a insurance pool or any way that we would be covered insurance-wise if we actually did this in Big Lake?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe. I am unaware of that insurance issue. We do for the snow trails groups and actually the ice road groups, we do require a general liability insurance, and everybody has been able to obtain that insurance. But I was not aware that Big Lake had this issue.
Follow up? Yeah, so the issue was is they, I mean, there's maybe a half dozen guys that do it with their trucks, right? And they got together and they talked, and, you know, I presented this to them when the DOT 3 years ago, I think, or 2 years ago, when we started sort of building up this ice road program. And they took a hard look at it and trying to find the insurance, and it was a struggle. So maybe there's a way that the DOT has an insurer or somebody that will that they can maybe not recommend, but, you know, they can support a bond or something, and that would be helpful because these guys are doing it. It's like bake sale donations to pay for their fuel. So
thank you. Through the chair, Senator McCabe, I'll certainly take that back. I'm sorry, Representative McCabe.
It's a promotion.
Sorry about
that.
It's
not a promotion.
And
I'm right where I belong.
Andy Mills, for the record. So through the co-chair to Representative McCabe, yeah, I did. That was on my radar as an issue for them. We haven't talked about an insurance pool, but we certainly could look at what the possibilities might be. There would be questions I know I have, such as if someone does create an issue, like when are they in or out? And we'd work through maybe the details on those. Did want to underscore before we leave ice roads, the importance of ice roads, not just in communities for access, but in the Typhoon Halong, by the way, it's been a vital connection that I just want to underscore. And actually, unfortunately, at this exact moment, we're losing some of the roads in as that warms up. Some of the ice roads are no longer able to be traversed, but the substantial savings in communities, if Ms. Garrett wants to add to that, I know they've been vital in getting low-cost fuel and other items in and out, particularly during a season where we're doing active recovery efforts.
Through the chair, Rebecca Garrett again. Yes, with Typhoon Halong, we did ask the entity that creates this Kuskokwim Ice Road, which is Napayamute Village, to extend to Tuntutuliak, which is an extra 42 miles that they don't particularly do every year. They've done it once or twice as a emergency or a one-time thing. They were able to put it in this year. It has been a good year for the ice road in general. That area it's right on the edge, so it's difficult ice, and the wind blows down there, so it's hard to maintain it. We were able to transfer through the emergency response a FAA grader that had been at DOT so that they could maintain this road. But now that they've had it maintained and marked, they're going to want it in the future. It's been great. So that's something that we're considering and looking at. And then in addition, we just received a request from the Northwest Arctic Borough to fund a much extended road. They currently have the road from Kotzebue to Kiana, but they would like to extend. They actually don't build their road until this time of year, and it's only open for a month or so. But we are searching for funds to potentially get to them so that they can get that in place and complete response to some emergencies that they've had up there as well.
Okay, great. I have Representative Nelson in the queue.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And to Ms. Garrett, to follow up on the point that you were just making, and I don't know if you have exact numbers or just rough numbers, but As far as maintaining ice roads, which, you know, we have unique challenges in Alaska, and we address them, and this is one of the ways that we address them. How much does the DOT spend on building and maintaining these ice roads a year?
Through the chair to Representative Nelson. I believe right now we have about $2.5 million awarded to different entities. DOT does not build these ice roads. We award them to interested applicants who have typically been Native villages or local public entities like the Northwest Arctic Borough.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, please continue.
Thank you. Rebecca Garrett for the record. The winter trail marking program focuses on safety by installing high visibility markers along winter routes. In Alaska, conditions where weather can change quickly, these markers help people navigate safely between communities and key destinations. They also play an important role in search and rescue, giving responders a defined route system to work from. This is a partnership model. Typically, DOT handles the design and environmental work, and local partners install the markers. We continue to see growing interest in the program across the state. Current applications represent hundreds of miles of trail. The final program focuses on maintaining winter trails through partnerships with local organizations. The Snow Trails program supports groomed winter trails primarily maintained by local nonprofit organizations. These trails provide reliable winter access and are used by a wide range of users, including snow machines, skiers, and dog teams. Currently, we have about 1,650 miles of trails groomed each year. The program is funded through snow machine registration fees along with federal and state support. However, the cost of maintaining these trails greatly exceeds available funding and demand continues to grow. This is a strong public-private partnership model, but it relies heavily on local capacity and limited sources. Registration fees alone are not sufficient to sustain this program, which creates an ongoing funding gap. These trails also support local economies and tourism.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett. We have a question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So what is the delta basically between, you talked about the shortfall essentially through, it's funded through registration fees and state support, and then the demand exceeds available funding. Like, what is the difference there? Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Nelson. We receive about $90,000 a year in registration fees. The application total for this year for snow trails was $3.1 million. We had $1.8 million available, so we reduced the budgets across the board. And then we were anticipating receiving federal funds, which we did not receive until March 27th. Most of the season is over, but this is still cause for celebration because we did secure those federal funds.
Follow up. Out of that, did the 1.3 include the federal dollars? Or
through the chair to Representative Nelson, it was 1.7, I believe, that was available to, and then the applications were for $3.1 million.
Okay.
So original applications, 3.1. Available funding, 1.7.
How much of that was federal?
The 1.7 was federal.
Okay. So you, follow up. So you got 90,000 in fees. There was 3.1 in applications. Okay. That answers my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah. So, what ends up happening is the trails still get plowed, they still get groomed, but the volunteers do it with their own money, or they like Big Lake Trails collects money from their members, and they use that to fund the trails. So they're still getting done, even though there is a budgetary shortfall. I will tell you that the problem, and I looked into this a couple of years ago, the problem, and this is for the committee, is that you buy a snow machine, you register your snow machine, and then you never register it again, even though the registration typically is 1 or 2 years. So there is a way to fix this, but it involves a Republican putting out a tax and a fee. So we talked about doing a $100 Z tag on a snow machine, right, instead of a $20 yearly registration fee, because most snow machines last five years, right, before they're parked or sold off or something. But the problem is there is no requirement, there's no enforcement of having a tag on your snow machine. Like in Minnesota, if you're in a state park and you don't have the Minnesota tag on it, you're going to get a fine, right? Here in Alaska, that's so far beneath what the troopers are doing right now that they're... So the problem is, how do we get the money that we need for this snow track funding, snow trails funding, from the people that are closest to using it? And it's an interesting dilemma. So sorry, just thought I'd throw that context out there.
Super interesting. Very interesting. And maybe the Transportation Committee could consider something like that.
Maybe a Democrat on the Transportation Committee could consider that.
I didn't say me. I think, did Mr. Mills, did you have a comment here?
Andy Mills, for the record. Just a comment that I think Representative McCabe did cover, but enforcement really is the other piece of that. And in conversations with... various user groups, I think that there is an appetite for a potential more permanent solution that would capture more up front and just be an enduring solution, because doing the basic math, if it was 90,000 available of, in the legislature, I believe authorized up to 120,000, but if the overall program of 1.7, you take 10% of that is what we need a match to fulfill. And if you were to do much higher than that, if you were trying to fund all of the requests up to 3 million, that's a substantial amount more that you would need to. And that, by the way, I will note just as an additional, when DNR was operating the program, they had grooming pools. And so largely by user groups, that was seen as if you were in the program, your trail was sort of in. And if you weren't in the program, it was already being used effectively for certain regular customers, let's call it. And anything outside of that that might be new, there was not capacity for the program to take care of. One of the things that DOT we certainly look forward to, especially with finally getting over the hump with our federal partners to get federal funding flowing and we have the critical path determined, is potentially asking where else is there demand so that we can have the conversations about both the match and the federal funding to meet the total demand and grow this program so that there's additional access out there for the user groups we know want that access.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. And so one of, just for information again, one of the things about this is it brings in millions of dollars in wintertime recreation dollars to Big Lake, to Trapper Creek, to Sheep Creek Lodge, to all those places up around Petersville. Some of the lodges and places to stay in the Petersville area are only open in the winter. And they rely on these groomed trails. People park their cars and they get in there and they go out and they. So it's, you know, if we're going to help infrastructure, help commerce, this is an important way to do this. And this comes from a couple years ago when I looked into this quite a bit. But it's an interesting sort of excursion, if you will, bunny trail, snowmobile trail.
Co-Chair Eichheim.
Yeah, just through the co-chair, I just want to make a comment what Representative McCabe just said. You know, in Wisconsin, where I spent 30 years, you know, it's snowmobiles down there rather than snow machines. But snowmobile culture is huge, and it's a huge economic driver. And a big part of that is trail grooming. And it's huge. The one thing we lack is we lack snow sometimes. But you look at, especially northern Wisconsin, which is more rural, the supper clubs and the bars, there's lots of them in Wisconsin. It's a huge thing. Lots of snow machine clubs, and it's a real huge economic driver. And, of course, there is enforcement. We have, you know, we have sheriffs. We have other folks out there in snow machines. So people do pay their fair share, but it's... Yeah, it's good for business. It's really good for business.
And
Mr. Mills.
Just one more comment. Andy Mills for the record. We did try, and we need to maybe keep this in the mix, the last fund tier. We did try to push on that. I believe it was a year and a half ago. That was an overall sort of initiative that the governor was asking for agencies, and DOT embraced that by saying, if we can try to promote, again, elements like this where folks are having fun, Alaska is a more desirable place to live. To Co-Chair Eichheit's point, the more we can have an environment in Alaska where people want to live here, it has all of these very positive ancillary benefits, not just having fun, but the economic activity, people living here. So it's very much, it sounds like a policy prescription that until you start putting meat to it and say, this is how we can reverse the demographic decline and our outward migration in the state. So.
Thank you. Ms. Garrett, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Rebecca Garrett. Across all four programs, we are seeing strong demand and clear benefits, but also some common challenges. First, demand consistently exceeds available funding, particularly as communities become aware of these programs. Second, federal match requirements can be a barrier, especially for smaller or rural communities with limited resources. Third, for programs like Ice Roads, access to equipment and local capacity can limit the project delivery. And finally, as these programs grow, there is a need for additional administrative capacity to manage them effectively. These aren't barriers to the programs, they're just opportunities to strengthen the delivery with the right support. There are several opportunities where the legislative support could help strengthen these programs. First, stable and predictable funding would help us better plan and deliver projects across all four programs. Second, reducing barriers to participation, particularly around match requirements, would allow more rural communities to take part. Third, investment in equipment and local capacity could directly support project delivery, especially for the ice roads. And finally, continuing to integrate Atlas into the statewide transportation planning ensures these systems are recognized as part of Alaska's broader network. These targeted investments can significantly expand access without the cost of traditional road construction. I'll close with what success looks like for all these programs to continue to grow in their ability to connect and serve more communities while maturing in their sophistication to better meet the demand across our state.
And we can pause here briefly, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, could you talk a little bit more about the barriers for rural communities? I assume it might be lack of local revenue, or are there other legislative barriers that we would be able to tackle?
Through the Chair to Representative Mina. Yes, I believe the match, it can be a barrier to rural communities. Typically, these ice roads are supported by villages. And they do require, at this point, a 9.03% match. If we change the funding source for the ice roads, which we might, to the RTP program, it would be a 10% match. Right now, they are typically making that in kind, but it can add up for sure. Then, in addition, some communities would like to participate, but they don't have the equipment, and the equipment is a major investment. As I mentioned earlier, Tuntutuliak is enjoying their access to the ice road, and so they reached out about how they could get a grader. So I've been looking around for opportunities for funding to purchase equipment, but it can be very difficult across programs.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I have a, I don't know where to fit it in here, but I have a question too about when we talk about allocating the resources, we go back to the Rural Trails program and the distribution 30% to motorized, 30% to non-motorized. In the winter, it's easy here because snow machines improve trails and trail access for people just by going over an area with a snow machine. Now it can be used for dog sledding and skiing and additional snow machining. In the spring and summer, though, four-wheeling trails, if they're not done on a explicitly motorized trail, can, in just a few minutes, destroy a trail, you know, not for the motorized user, but for all future users on that trail. So it's, I'm wondering about funding on summer to winter motorized access, if you have a comment there, because they do create different challenges and opportunities, those different user groups in the motorized community. And I have a follow-up too, but maybe we could start there if Mr. Mills has any comment on how we distribute funding.
To Madam Co-Chair, on that one, I guess I would, one, maybe challenge the premise just a little bit, although I acknowledge absolutely that in the summertime, or especially during breakup, when things haven't firmed up, it can cause significant damage to dirt and trails. But in the wintertime, I know from hearing from stakeholders that there are, someone's going to help me with this, what is the triangle-shaped treads you can put on a truck to make it?
Tracks.
Okay, I live in Juneau, so I don't know what the term is, but everyone from the Matsu knows. So apparently if you take these onto some of the trails, it can really tear the snow trail up to where other users cannot enjoy it to the same degree. So I think this dynamic exists in either case, and in most cases that's going to result, or that's only going to be mitigated by enforcement, good enforcement, perhaps even, again, public education. We need to engage with folks who might not be aware that their activities are destroying that access for others. And so, again, it's a combination of things. Did I answer the question for you?
Yes, and it's actually a perfect segue, because the follow-up question is, as part of the Recreational Trails Program or through Atlas or some other source through DOT, is there either current or planned education, outreach and education efforts around particularly spring trail use, because that's where a lot of those user groups tend to intersect and interfere with each other most significantly? But just, I mean, in Fairbanks, we have our borough, I believe. Don't quote me on it. But I think our borough does some outreach about spring trail use, and please don't bring your four-wheelers on certain trails in the May to mid-June timeframe. But is there any effort to also do some of that outreach and education through the Atlas program or DOT's programs?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Rebecca Garrett. We do have a safety and education component under multi-use trails, but that is more about the trail that might be right there and opportunities to engage people with the environment at wherever the placards are. We do not have a educational program right now, but it is certainly a good point and something I will take back to consider.
And then I guess one more follow-up is, similarly, having traveled to a couple of communities outside of Kotzebue where the trail marking program is a really significant utilized service, there's always conflict around whether to do trail marking or not to do trail marking, because people will utilize certain existing long traverse traditional trails and pathways even when they're not safe. And I know that is something that DPS has commented on for some communities. So is there outreach and communication around safe use of both ice roads and trails that have trail markings on them for rural communities? Or is that coming through other sources?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is Rebecca Garrett. The ice road, the communities that build the ice road, they do mark them, that say they set up a detour, they put up warning signs, and they do close the road with markings. However, we do receive pictures of vehicles driving around those markings and using them. We do not currently have a plan for safety on these winter trails or the ice roads, but it's something that we can certainly work with our RTEC committee on, especially with the addition of Allie Sargent on that team.
Okay, great. I think it's also probably worth noting that there's other, you know, the tribal groups that are ultimately executing the contracts or the work on it, they do a lot of outreach and education. I was just curious what DOT's role in that is, so thank you for that answer. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, kind of related to this conversation, I have a constituent who's very passionate about K-Trucks, and I was curious about how you all regulate which vehicles are allowed on which trails, and is that in regulation or is that in statute?
Through the co-chair to Representative Mina, I don't know what a K-truck is.
Representative St. Clair.
Well, I'm the automobile guy, I guess. Thank you, Madam Chair. And because this did come up and it came to my office and then went over to Representative Minas, it is basically a quarter-ton truck with very small wheels. It's like the Japanese ones and the Korean ones. You know what I'm talking about? It's those are the ones. And actually those are pretty good stout vehicles too. But the ability to on the off-road trails, like Representative Mina was talking about, drive those on the some of the motorized. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Andy Mills, for the record. So yeah, I was wondering if it was those, and that confirms it. So for enforcement, that's not a DOT related activity. There's a lot of areas where we do enforcement from a financial or compliance standpoint, but enforcement would probably, I'm guessing, defer to DPS on roadways, on DNR for parks, on local jurisdictions if it's a local park. I mean, I know that there's a difference between fed, state, and local trails here in Juneau. I'm assuming that same paradigm is across the entire state, depending on the jurisdiction, and that enforcement would default to whoever the jurisdiction of the trail is. I do know as a tag in, just as one thing, it is actually a very valid conversation to be sure we're having when we talk about smaller light duty vehicles and what that means for trails, in that DOT has been working towards these smaller span bridges that could really connect more frontier style roads. We've talked for a few years now about Wood Canyon. I think that's south of the Chittenden area, and there's an area we're trying to span a river, but with a different spec'd span, a bridge, and because bridges can get quite expensive, but if you're not planning to bring large haul vehicles, but instead ATVs, UTVs, Argos, whatever it is, K trucks, you could certainly, again, spec that smaller span that is doing a more trail or frontier road style connection, and that would make a lot of sense. So we should keep that in the mix of conversations on enforcement on those types of connections.
Thank you.
I did not think we'd be talking about K trucks today.
Oh, I really appreciate it.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm wondering if, you know, we already do road restrictions for commercial vehicles in the spring, right, during breakup. I wonder if that's not something that we could maybe even just through education initially, but certainly I kind of agree with the Representative Carrick. It in the springtime is horrible. But if we can keep them on trails in the summertime, then they don't go off-road so much and create an even worse mess. So I think the trails are important, but I think it's important to help people understand that there's times when you just can't go on there, even with a K-truck or even with a light four-wheeler. So, yeah, right?
Yeah. There are some, just speaking from experience with interior trails, can be really, really detrimental to even the future four-wheeler users for the rest of the summer. One or two people go out in May not on a motorized trail. It can make that motorized trail essentially unusable for all but the most expert motorized users and unusable for anyone else. So education and outreach on that issue is really important. Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. This is so interesting to me, this whole topic. Again, Wisconsin, so where I would go cross-country skiing, the Green Bush Trail area. And this was an area with, you know, a wide groomed track. You know, you could take a K-truck down it easily. So, and again, you had multiple users. So during the warm season, is a mountain biking trail. But in the spring, as the frost was going out of the ground, there was no skiing and there was no bikes allowed. You know, and they're posted. And again, this was part of a state forest, so there was enforcement. You know, without enforcement, it's always going to be education and hopefully people policing themselves, saying, hey, what are you doing out here right now with this thing? Sometimes that's what it takes. But yeah, there's models out there.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The reality is that people don't enforce themselves. And so education is only going to matter to the people that want to get it. And to what Mr. Mills was saying, the question I have, the times that I've seen this, you know, a lot of the trails, as Madam Co-Chair, you were mentioning, are used by hikers and by people on mountain bikes and then four-wheelers and then side-by-sides, which are more capable than Jeeps. And then, yes, they can tow more and they can haul more and they can haul more people. And then K-trucks. And then, I mean, like, we just go up the realm there. The times that I've seen this effective is like in my time in Idaho, when there's an actual natural choke point to where, you know, you put up a sign and you say you can't do this and people just drive around it. But to like your bridges example, like natural choke points, is there in statute the way that I've seen it in Idaho, it's limited on the width of the vehicle. Like if it's going through a parking lot or something like that, that it literally, I mean, like ATV and side-by-side companies, they build their machines to coincide with the width requirements. And maybe a K-truck would fit through, but a CJ5 won't. And so is there anything like that in statute to where when you're talking about like with this bridge project, like natural places where there's no other option to cross and you can limit the size or the weight of the vehicle based on width? That's the only time that I've seen it effective, frankly, is like in like the Pacific Northwest. Is there anything like that that you guys could apply?
Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to Representative Nelson, I don't believe there's something in statute per se, but again, the specifications by our bridge section would be what would give sort of the restrictive nature of the design. And of course, you could, through active management, do the what many people do, which is you'll put boulders so that only bikes and pedestrians can go through. Here in Juneau, I've seen chains that are locked up. I know there's a lot of management approaches to trying to keep certain traffic, but I don't believe there's anything statutorily. I think it's, again, the specifications that would be in the design to then restrict to width or what you were trying to do. Other than that, you're right. It's posting signs and looking for compliance or enforcement.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
I just want to make clear that I'm not advocating that we do that, but what Rep. St. Clair brought up, like especially with spring bear hunting, if we're going to try and limit things to June, I mean, that's when you're pulling baits out, you know. And so just something to keep in mind. Like, I understand the challenge it can create, and it has created some even in my own backyard, but I recognize the challenge. But I just didn't know if there was something that was enforceable at this point. So thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Excellent. I don't see any further questions, so we can go ahead and continue and finish our presentation, Ms. Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Rebecca Garrett. Success for the Atlas programs means more connected communities across Alaska, particularly in areas without traditional road access. It means more reliable access to essential services like healthcare, education, and regional hubs. It also means safer travel, both for people using these routes and for search and rescue operations. And importantly, it allows us to expand Alaska's transportation system in a cost-effective way where building permanent roads isn't always feasible due to the cost of construction in remote areas or the site conditions themselves. Atlas allows us to expand across Alaska in a way that is practicable, scalable, and responsible to how Alaskans actually travel.
Thank you very much, Ms. Garrett and Mr. Mills. Do we have any final questions for our presenters today? Seeing none. Oh, Co-Chair Eisheid. Never mind.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I had two questions. The first one is, does any of this work apply to these historic trails, the RS-2477 trails? Does this any of this work apply to them?
Through Co-Chair Carrick to Co-Chair Eisheid. Yes, the multi-use trail program offers opportunity to work on those trails to for maintenance. I'm sorry, the word was escaping me, for maintenance and improvement. And there's a couple of folks on the RTAC committee who are very interested in seeing opportunities for these trails to move forward.
Okay, and then follow-up question. So does this program also have relevance to the long trail, to segments of the long trail, developing maintenance? The Alaska Long Trail.
What?
Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to co-chair Eichheit. My understanding on the Long Trail is that they might apply for an RTP grant as they apply for other sources of funding to make connections. I will say on the funding piece, prompting your question, that is one of the challenges for Alaska is to try and fit some of these unique solutions into the federal funding that we do receive. And obviously state funding right now is a premium. But you'll note that under IIJA, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or Bill, Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, there were provisions that allowed for eligibility of certain funding and that did enable some of the ice roads that we're doing now. So as every five-year surface reauthorization comes, we're always looking for additional opportunities to get that Alaska-specific take. So we are working with our congressional delegation to say, here are some areas we want to continue to push on, using either existing funding or finding ways to extend funding to some of these non-traditional Alaska-specific solutions. So.
Okay. I don't see any additional questions, so I just want to thank Ms. Garrett and Mr. Mills again for talking to us today about the ATLAS program, or Alaska Trails and Local Access Systems. Just for members' information before we adjourn today, those of us on this committee who are available on Thursday afternoon. I know some people do have planned travel and will be out of town then, but for those who are here, we are still looking to potentially host a demonstration this Thursday as a field trip. The avalanche demonstration we had to reschedule from last week. We will await final confirmation about if that trip is available based on weather, and we should know within about a day or so. And Mr. Mills will get back to us. With nothing else before House Transportation, we are adjourned at 2:13 p.m.